Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Recent technical research at the National Gallery of Art explores artistic exchange among the painters featured in the exhibition Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting, Inspiration and Rivalry, on view from October 22, 2017 through January 21, 2018. In this lecture, held on October 30, 2017, as part of the Works in Progress series, Melanie Gifford and Leisha Glintzman share discoveries from their research. Study reveals that these elegant scenes, painted for an elite Dutch art market, shared physical characteristics that defined a collective high life style. At the same time, the research shows that painters each marketed their works by cultivating a distinctive personal manner, and that through subtle variations of technique and materials, they could sell at somewhat different price levels. Finally, technical study offers direct evidence for 17th century artists' evaluations of their contemporaries' artistic style, the recognizable features they selected and quoted in their own works for the amusement of sophisticated collectors.
My colleague Leisha and I would like today to share some of the work we did for the exhibition that's on view right now. We are just one of a number of research initiatives that were undertaken in preparation for this project. And this research informs the final product, both the exhibition and the catalog. Our work was on the painting techniques of the so-called high life genre painters. And our essay goes into much more detail. But today we'd like to give you just a brief taste of what we did. The paintings in this exhibition represent a shift to a new and modern style of painting around 1650. And the question comes up, how did the sublime mode of painting come about in just 20 or 25 years? My nickname for the exhibition is Vermeer and some other guys, because this, of course, is not, in fact, a Vermeer show, though we have 10 Vermeers in the show. Actually, this exhibition explores the rivalry and emulation and admiration among a network of peers, not a leader and follower. If you consider the spectacular paintings by other artists, you'll see, on the left, Frans van Mieris, on the right, Gerard Terborch. Vermeer was certainly not an isolated phenomenon. If genre paintings as a group depict scenes from daily life, these particular genre paintings represent an idealized contemporary society, showing the highest level of society with beautiful people, rich clothing and furnishings. These were painted by artists who were competing for the attention of a new generation of committed and very well-informed collectors. The exhibition groups paintings by shared subjects or themes, but artists were in fact aware of many different aspects of each other's work. If we consider, for example, Caspar Netscher's Woman at Her Toilet, this painting shows echoes and perhaps pays homage to Netscher's teacher, Terborch, his painting of the same subject. But Netscher also elegantly weaves that reference together with formal compositional references to another artist's work. In the table below the unseen window, and the wash of light over the woman in the rear wall, and the framed painting which frames the woman herself, connoisseurs would surely have recognized and appreciated the references to Vermeer. But just as artists made reference to other artists' compositions, they also quoted each other's manner of painting. And our project was a technical study to consider how the manner of painting created this distinctive and elegant style. We posed three questions. We wanted to consider the collective style. What did these artists have to do for their works to still be considered high life genre paintings? And to appeal to buyers of this elite art market. We also wanted to consider personal style, because buyers weren't just seeking any old generic high life painting. They wanted works by specific artists. And we wanted to consider quotations of style, style and not only compositions, and to think about how these quotations might illuminate our understanding of 17th century attitudes toward style. So we'll start by taking a few moments to lay out the methodology of our technical study. Leisha and I traveled together quite extensively to examine 105 paintings by 12 artists. Now, with this kind of a data set, obviously, we weren't doing in-depth analysis of just a few paintings. Instead, we worked out a consistent examination protocol that we used throughout this large group of works. And we focused on two examination methods that gave a common thread to all our observations. I carried out magnified examination of all the paintings, and Lisha carried out XRF examination of most of them. The primary method for understanding the handling of paint and the development of the compositions was magnified examination. Where available, we used research microscopes in the laboratories we were visiting, and where there wasn't a laboratory on site, we used a portable handheld microscope. And I'll illustrate my observations with a painting by Vermeer because his handling of paint is not as minute as some in the group, so it's a little easier to see how he works. With magnification, you can see the painting sequence, the order in which he applied things like the brown painted sketch, which is peeking through here, which he used to first lay out his design, then the underpaint, then the final paint, and his final dots of highlight that are so characteristic. With even higher magnification, we can also visually characterize the microscopic particles of pigments, those colorants the artist chose for their paints. And here you see the beautiful blue, typical of ultramarine blue, and the frosty yellow, typical of lead tin yellow. When combined with X-ray fluorescence analysis by Lisha, these visual observations offered solid identification of the pigments used. And now Lisha will take over for a while to tell us about the material analysis.
In addition to microscopic examination, as Melanie has just said, X-ray fluorescence, also known as XRF, was performed on most of the paintings examined. The image on the left shows me setting up the handheld XRF unit. Our XRF doesn't require taking a sample or having contact with the painting. It can be mounted on a tripod and focused on a small area of the painting. The picture on the right shows our setup taken when Melanie and I were examining Vermeer's Milkmaid one evening after hours in the Hall of Honor at the Rijksmuseum. As I was wrapping up the XRF analyses, I saw Rembrandt's Night Watch in the background being framed by my easel, and I couldn't resist taking this painting. Picture, I should say. XRF identifies the elements present in the painting, and this information is used to assist in the identification of pigments. Here is a detail from Tobork's Intruder of the lute player's blue bodice to illustrate how pigments are inferred using this technique. X-rays from the instrument excite the material in the painting, generating characteristic X-rays. These show up as peaks in the spectrum. The XRF spectrum from the blue bodice shows the presence of aluminum, silica, and potassium. This elemental profile is consistent with natural ultramarine blue. Ultramarine blue is a costly pigment made from lapis lazuli. It's a semi-precious stone, and it's frequently found in high-life paintings. XRF can even identify drifts of fine ultramarine, impossible to see with the naked eye. To make the white satin highlights even whiter is illustrated here in the detail of Metsu's Intruder. And even though there's only very small trace amounts of it, you can still see the little peaks for aluminum, silica, and potassium. To keep track of all our observations, we created a FileMaker Pro database of specific features we were interested in tracking. As you can see, it was challenging to visualize patterns by scanning through columns of data. So we turned to Tableau. It's a data visualization software package as a starting point to open new questions and reconsider our examinations of individual paintings. One view in Tableau plots geographical relationships, and here is a plot of cities in which all the paintings examined were made. The size of the circles corresponds to the number of paintings from that area. Clearly, high life genre painting is not a localized phenomenon in Holland. One of the most essential lessons of this project was how important colors and the subtle distinction of color were to this group of artists. They had a wide-ranging palette, and each color was chosen for specific visual qualities. An example of this is Dow's subtle choices of blues. A detail here of the table carpet reveals where a more muted green-blue verditer was used, Blue verditer was also used in the maid's skirt. The brilliant blue curtain, sky, and deep blue of the tapestry was achieved using ultramarine blue. Considering the use of red pigments, here are two lush red velvet jackets frequently depicted in high life paintings. On the left, Dao creates the red of his velvet jacket by using mostly an opaque orange-red vermilion, while Terborch uses a transparent red lake. In this closer detail, you can see that Dao paints the deeper shadows over the vermilion with glazes of a more purple-toned red lake. His variations of color and transparency defined a play of light on the gleaming folds. In contrast, Terborch painted his jacket with a thickly applied, transparent, deep red lake to evoke the depth of color in the rich velvet fabric. Looking at the yellows, Vandermeer achieved the three-dimensional effect in the ribbons on the page's costume by using two different opaque yellow pigments to model light and shade. He first painted the duller, more brown-yellow ochre color, and then he ran highlights of bright reflective lead tin yellow along the edges, which are outlined with black. The primary green pigment these artists used was verdigris. To catch the viewer's eye, Van Mieris used a relatively pure verdigris in his fine brushwork in the chair, along with some lead tin yellow highlights. He placed less visual emphasis on the work cushion with a muted green color created by mixing into the verdigris other pigments such as iron earth. 17th century Dutch artists did not have many options for green pigments and frequently complained about the harshness of verdigris and often chose to mix blues and yellows to expand the range of greens. Using Tableau visualization software, we began to look for patterns in pigments used by the artist. Questions like, were costly pigments such as ultramarine blue typical for a high life genre painting? Returning to the geographical plot of cities in which all the paintings we studied were made, and then mapping the paintings in which ultramarine blue were identified reveals there's no obvious regional focus. In other words, the distribution of ultramarine blue is similar to the geographic distribution of where the paintings were made. The cost of ultramarine blue was extraordinary. 1 ounce cost as much as 10% of a typical craftsman's income. Even more extraordinary, ultramarine blue was used not only for the obvious blue areas, but even in underpaint. One example of this is a detail of the chair in Terborch's A Suitor's Visit, where you can clearly see the ultramarine blue peeking out from beneath the green glaze. Here is another view of the data, now in table format, showing all the paintings with blue pigments. The vertical axis is the dates of the paintings, while the horizontal axis is artists ranked by prices achieved, with the most expensive being Van Mieris on the left. This is based on archival data gathered by other colleagues on the exhibition project, and it's published in the exhibition catalog. High life genre is at the top of the art market in mid-17th century Netherlands. This period had an enormous income disparity for artists, even among the elite high life specialists. Dao and Van Mieris obtained by far the highest prices. Dao once received an astounding 4,000 guilders for one painting. Vermeer, Netscher, Vandermeer, and Terborch achieved very good prices, around 300 or more guilders per painting. Artists on the far right of the graph, Achtervelt, Steyn, De Hoek, averaged just 30 to 60 guilders per painting. When we filtered the graph to highlight occurrences of ultramarine blue, we found it was widespread among this group. And so the gray here are blue pigments that were not ultramarine, such as like indigo, smalt, blue verditer. But we can see by looking at this graph that there was a trend associated with the painters achieving the highest prices. Looking at artists who don't exclusively use ultramarine blue became particularly informative. Jan Steyn's use of blue pigment shows an intriguing variable pattern. He is an artist who usually painted modest low-life scenes, as seen here in The May Queen, where smalt was used for the blue sky. And I should note at this point that smalt was actually sold in barrels, and it was used for bluing in laundry. So it was really a cheap pigment. It's made out of blue glass. But on a few occasions when he painted high-life scenes, As shown here, where ultramarine blue was used in all four instances related to his most refined high life paintings we examined, this suggests the use of ultramarine blue is closely associated with this style of painting. Other variations in the use of blue pigments by moderate and lower priced artists led us to other strategic choices. De Hoogh created effects reminiscent of Vermeer, but more economically. Vermeer exclusively used ultramarine blue in his paintings. Vermeer would achieve the effect of cool light on a rear wall with adding ultramarine blue into his white paint. De Hoogh, on the other hand, mixed the inexpensive blue smalt into the white rear wall to achieve a similar effect. However, in the more important details, such as the design in the Delft tiles or the ribbons in the child's dress, De Hoogh would selectively use ultramarine blue where it counted. Melanie is now going to discuss the consequences of how these color choices affected the paintings as we currently see them today.
So despite the focus on precious material among this group, and their wide-ranging palette necessarily included some unstable pigments to get the variety of effects they needed. Many of the pigments they used did have a reputation for high quality and long life. So sources, for example, recommend ultramarine for this reason. But the lake colors in particular do have a drawback, and artists knew it. Lake colors are transparent pigments, as Lisha has described, because they are a dye precipitated onto a transparent particle. And the dyes are just the same dyes that were used for fabrics. So just as in your personal experience, you know that fabrics exposed to light will fade, so will dyes on pigments fade when they are exposed to light. And the yellow dye used for a yellow lake was particularly prone to fading, and our sources, the artist's sources in the 17th century, warned them about this. But the nuances of color they could achieve with a varied palette were so important that these artists seem to have accepted that risk. As Lisha showed you, the blue dress is made with ultramarine, and XRF saw the characteristic elements. But you'll notice that there's also a peak for calcium, and this is an associated mineral typically found along with natural ultramarine. Now, we also analyzed the blue in the carpet on the table, and again, we saw the aluminum, silica, and potassium. But we saw calcium at a much, much higher level in this area. From a previous study, we believe strongly that this is evidence that there was a yellow lake mixed with the ultramarine in this area, because typically yellow lakes were precipitated onto chalk or calcium carbonate as the transparent particle. So the presence of an excessive amount of calcium is indicative of the presence of the yellow lake. From this information, we infer that the dress and the carpet design weren't both blue. The design was green. This realization has pushed us to speculate graphically on how this painting might have looked before its color change. Now, this gives us an opportunity to recalibrate our eyes to this possibility. In this painting, the color range seems moderately limited in this area. There's the blue in the dress and in the carpet, and there's a green chair. But we tried to imagine the subtle increments of color that we've seen in other cases. Now, we don't want to suggest that we know exactly what the original appearance would have been, so we don't want to colorize an exact record of the painting, but we've created instead a schematized image. And this allows us to focus on the general effect of the color harmonies. And in this image, you can see two distinct zones in this area of the composition. The lute player in blue, leaning on the table, is leaning on a blue patterned tablecloth, and this blue zone forms one unit. In front of her, the deep green chair is a separate unit, forming an emphatic repoussoir, holding us back from the composition. But with just a small change, introducing a muted green into the carpet instead of blue, the composition itself changes subtly. The color we chose for this rendering is based on our analysis and our estimation of the color that would result from ultramarine blue with a generous amount of yellow lake. These increments of color now translate to increments of space as well. The table now occupies a middle zone between the green chair and the woman in blue. In effect, it gives her breathing room to play her lute. Now, color change is not unique to Ter Borch's painting, of course, and it's something we all need to think about as we go through the exhibition. We can't know exactly, as I say, what the original appearance might have been, but in one particular case, we have zoological evidence. You're looking here at paintings by Gerrit Dou on the left and Frans van Mieris on the right. The parrots gave us an opportunity to compare the color to known models. Now, at this point, the parrots look fairly similar, but we realize they actually must be different species because of the different pattern of red on the tail on the right and on the wing on the left. Van Mieris, it was known, painted an elegant, subtle gray parrot known as an African gray. But we found out that Dou originally had painted a much brighter bird. Thanks to Smithsonian ornithologists, we now know this was a blue-fronted Amazon. On the head of the bird, Dou left the ultramarine underpaint visible to form the blue front of the species name. But over most of the bird, he applied a final glaze of yellow lake. That yellow lake now, unfortunately, is faded and murky, but we believe that the artist must have found its transparency essential to at least approximate the deeply saturated yellow-green of the actual bird. So far, our discussion of color in general and pigments in specific have mostly considered the first of the questions we posed, the creation of a collective style of characteristics that appear in most of these paintings. Stepping on to question two, personal style, we can consider the handling of paint. Here we see that artists were balancing collective expectations for their paintings, but also their personal style. Now, fine-scaled brushwork is often interpreted as a universal feature of this group, and we wanted to see if this was true. What you're looking at here is a tiny early work by Gerrit Dou, with remarkably fine detail. Dou is known as the father of the Leiden Feinschilders, or fine painters, and connoisseurs were awed by his time-consuming technique, and in fact, he boasted of his technique and how long it took. When Sandrart visited his studio, he admired a broomstick that he said was no bigger than a thumbnail. And Dou poo-pooed him and said, "Oh, I've got 3 days of work left in that." Dou's student, Frans van Mieris, was internationally celebrated and reached new levels of refinement and finesse with his almost invisible brush strokes. And with these strokes, he created subtle distinctions between the fine materials he depicted. But fine brushwork was not universal. We do, in fact, see personal variations. Metsu has a very recognizable way of painting that evokes fine painting, but is much quicker and more fluent. It's actually a much more efficient technique. He can manage to create the effect of a carpet or a convincing approximation of fine, precise brushwork with sharp details. So, for example, this little black shadow here throws that silver vessel into relief very efficiently. And Vermeer's personal approach, especially in his later works like this one in Dublin, doesn't even aspire to fine handling. Vermeer had a remarkably abstracted and schematic effect, and this evocative image is built just out of planes of light and shade. We wanted to quantify these observations to work out whether fine handling really was a fundamental characteristic or some kind of a prerequisite of high life genre. So again, a table like the one Lisha showed you. Again, the artists are arranged by price with the highest paid artists on the left. But this time we've plotted how prevalent fine brushwork was. Now, as you would have guessed from the details I just showed you, there was a range of handling, and we assigned colors. The green squares represent paintings with the most fine-scaled handling. Here is that Van Mieris painting. The purple squares represent moderately fine handling, and here is Metsu. And the orange marks are for comparatively broad brushwork, and here is Vermeer. Now, there is definitely a general trend toward fine handling. Clearly, green at the left is associated with higher prices, also at the left. But Vermeer is an interesting exception that reminds us that individuals are not always in lockstep with trends. He achieved very high prices, yet his personal style was comparatively broad. So if we ignore Vermeer, the exception, we see the overall trend now to be very clear. To achieve the highest prices at the far left of the chart, fine handling was virtually required unless you had a very distinctive style that people were still willing to pay for. Moderate and comparatively broad brushwork is clustered on the right, and presumably these were painters who worked with a less labor-intensive method and were able to create their paintings more quickly. If we look more closely at variations of personal style, we can consider paintings by Dou, Terborg, and Vermeer. They clearly were all working in a collective high-life style, yet each established a distinctive personal way of painting. We know from sources that knowledgeable collectors took delight in recognizing the manner of different artists. And we can see this by comparing the imported Turkish carpets and tapestries, which were markers of a wealthy household. Of course, the differences in the way artists applied their paint do have economic consequences, simply how fast they could paint. But these differences also were essential as they carved out a personal niche of personal style. Dou's meticulous technique was his trademark, and he truly was obsessive. So every thread of the tapestry is indicated by row upon row of separate dots of paint. Terborg has a wonderful stippled touch, and the texture of his dabs of paint are mimetic. They evoke the fuzzy surface of the tufted carpet. In the painting by Vermeer, the carpet is absolutely convincing, but with remarkably little detail. Vermeer conjures up this carpet simply by painting the play of light. And as we turn to the third question, modern viewers think that we see artists quoting each other's characteristic style. So we were looking for direct evidence. We were wondering that when artists quoted style, we wondered if they used the same techniques to reproduce the effect of another artist's work. Now, Terborg, who you see here, was famous for his depiction of white satin. In fact, it was lauded in poetry. And he was the first to depict this fabric in genre paintings. His brilliant suggestion of this costly fabric was crucial for the development of high life style. And virtually all artists adopted white satin as a signifier of elegance. And here again, you see Metsu. So the question was, did Metsu need to replicate Terborg's methods to create this beautiful effect? Terborg, on the left, created his astonishing light effects and set a standard for fellow artists. He created his yellow-gray harmony in slowly worked paint. He laid in yellow shadows, then light gray midtones, and then when they were dry, he applied thin white highlights, which he blurred with a blending brush. So, let me get closer. So this wonderful soft smudged effect is where he dragged a dry brush across the wet paint. The contrast of his translucent yellow shadows and the pure white play of light in the highlights was really a spectacular effect. Metsu is far more efficient, but until you get very close, his effects look very like Terborg's. Metsu painted all with opaque paints and worked more quickly wet in wet, but he implied Terborg's contrast of translucent shadows and opaque white highlights. He made his white highlights even cooler, as Lisha has already showed you, by adding fine ultramarine to the whitest of the highlights. And he evoked Terborg's blur of the blending brush with little crosswise strokes of paint. And in this area, I hope you can see he uses little tiny crosswise strokes. Van Mieris also had a trademark feature that was quoted by many of his peers. That was the ineffable shimmering light on the rich velvet jackets that he painted. And other artists, especially this chameleon Metsu, made very specific reference to Van Mieris's velvet. They quoted not only his compositions, but the velvet itself. But Metsu did this not by using the same time-consuming technique. He approximated the laborious shaping that Van Mieris used to shape the tucked sleeve with just dashes of white paint and a few flicks of red lake glaze on top of it. Buyers must have recognized the reference, surely, and I wonder if they were even appreciative of the witty shorthand with which Metsu recreated the effect. And finally, I'd like to close with evidence that the artist saw not only the other artists' compositions, not only their visual effects, but specific painting techniques as salient aspects of their fellow painters' styles. Cornelis de Man, like Vermeer, was based in Delft, and he clearly responds to the more accomplished fellow Delft artist. His generally workmanlike composition has high life features, certainly. There are scholars in a well-appointed study. There's a mirror on the back wall. And it also has specifically Vermeerian features in the quiet focus of those figures, in the wash of cool light. Intriguingly, this detail, which was pointed out to us by our Dublin colleague and catalog author, Adrian Vibor, is a clear reference to Vermeer. So we wondered, of course, how it's painted. A Washington audience will recognize that detail. But chairs with a lion's head finial are not unique to Vermeer. What is unusual is the quality of floating light. Vermeer's finial is painted with a brilliant wet-in-wet handling. De Man painted his finial in the same old routine methods he used to paint the rest of his painting. De Man laid out that finial with dark and mid-tone browns, using the same paint from the same palette that he was painting the architecture with. When the brown was dried, he went back and added a few ochre-colored dots and dashes, things like this, that I'm fairly certain are the same paint as the highlights on the nearby figure that he was painting at the same time. And then when those were dry, he added a few of the final white spots. By contrast, Vermeer placed varied tones of highlight onto paint, brown paint that was still wet. And his rounded touches of highlight suffused outward into the midtones. De Man recreated not the technique that Vermeer used, but simply the effect of his suffused highlights by blurring that intermediate stage of ochre yellow highlights. And I suspect that he too used a dry blender brush because you see these smudges where those yellows have been dragged sideways. For me, this confirms that De Man, and probably his buyers, saw the liquid quality of the highlights as an essential feature of Vermeer's style. Both artists lived in Delft, and so did most of their buyers. De Man's buyers were almost certainly less wealthy than Vermeer's, and maintaining his accustomed, efficient technique allowed him to price his work at a level that they could afford. The culture of collecting at this period suggests that potential buyers would have enjoyed De Man's artistic wit. Beyond broadly evoking high life genre, he tucked in a specific and recognizable Vermeerian detail as a clue. Our modern fascination with Vermeer's paintings is well known and is certainly justified. But the exhibition and this study offer us a small shift in perspective to see Vermeer's remarkable works in the context of an elite art market that included other remarkable artists, Dou, Terborch, Van Mieris, Metsu, and Vermeer. Collectively, these painters developed a shared style that marked their paintings as precious objects in their own right, with precious materials on a rich palette and fine handling. Each also carved out his own niche. And the delighted astonishment that 17th century art lovers felt, we feel today when confronted with their distinct personal styles. Dou's precise details, Van Mieris's imperceptible touch, Terborch's suggestive stippled strokes, and Metsu's fluent shorthand, and Vermeer's magical light. And Lisha and I would like to thank the remarkably generous colleagues who gave us access to paintings in their care and shared observations of the paintings they know so well. We also were the beneficiaries of generous travel support, because we did travel quite a bit. And we are very grateful to our curatorial colleagues. We work closely with the National Gallery's Arthur Wheelock and the National Gallery of Ireland's Adrian Vibor in particular. Thank you for your attention. And we can take any questions if people... Yes.
Could you comment on a documentary that came out a couple of years ago of showing, speculating about a mirror technique that Vermeer used to achieve his color effect?
You're talking about Tim's Vermeer, I think. Yeah, I did finally, everyone asked me to see it, had I seen it, and I did see the movie. I think it's a fascinating portrait of an obsessive, but the obsessive is not Vermeer. There's a lot of discussion of optical techniques and whether Vermeer took advantage of them. I think it's very clear visually that he was aware of camera obscura effects and had seen the use of a camera obscura, which is essentially like a camera that projects an image but without film. But I think there is no evidence that he painted by numbers, by copying directly from the screen of a camera obscura. There's a few pieces of evidence. One is that those wonderful floating highlights that he paints are a feature of a camera obscura, but they show up on reflective surfaces, and Vermeer paints them on things like white lace also, which is a matte surface that wouldn't do that in a camera obscura. So he's adopting this as a visual metaphor for light. There is also some evidence that the focal length of these various lenses that have been, when people have tried to do mock-ups, suggests that he might have been hovering over the canal beyond his house to get the entire setup in focus at once. And finally, I don't say this to the people who tell me directly that they can't copy Vermeer, but he was a very, very talented artist. And that's part of the explanation for how wonderful his paintings are. But that's my summary, a long summary. Other questions?
Are there any paintings that demonstrate the use of camera obscura?
Well, demonstration, as I say, is just visual evidence. So there are these wonderful floating circles of light that Vermeer uses as a metaphor. And they are very, very like the effect of a camera obscura's distortion on polished reflective surfaces. But he uses them in other areas as well.
Well, are there other artists that may have used it?
I don't know of other artists where it's so clear that there's this visual quality. I do know of artists who introduce those dots of light when they're quoting Vermeer. So other artists clearly also saw it as a characteristic of Vermeer's paintings. But what we know from most artists, they structured their space with very carefully designed perspective lines. And we even have pinholes where Vermeer, among others, pinned and drew strings to snap the orthogonals for their perspective structures in their paintings.
Yeah. Melanie, I know that both of you spent enormous time and travel making this project a reality. What is the future? Is this process going on in other museums? Are you the only ones in the world doing it?
Well, we don't. This won't go on indefinitely. We invested quite a lot of time. I should say that this is not the only project we ever work on. As I said earlier, your tax dollars at work, we're not going exclusively to this project. We do have one more publication coming out that will build on some of our observations, particularly about the use of color in this group. I think that's pretty much it at this point. It would.
Are there colleagues anywhere else?
There aren't technical studies being done.
There are studies of individual paintings. What actually I didn't go into, but what was quite intriguing about this study for us was that it's the most broad-ranging study like this that I think has been done in what's known as technical art history. For many years, we've done individual studies of monographic exhibitions here at the gallery that Arthur has mounted, and I've done several of those studies of individual artists. And that's very frustrating because you want to compare this artist to his peers, but there often is quite irregular information to compare to. So now we had this opportunity to, building on that previous work, to look at a whole network. And I think this is the largest one. I don't know of other people working on a study like this. But definitely, there's information all the time building on individual mm-hmm. studies. In fact, sitting right beside you is the author of a wonderful study on de Hoogh's paintings, Dina Anchin.
When you were doing the colors and you were doing your part with the...
XRF?
Yes, XRF. So did you look at a specific painting and decide just what areas you needed to know which colors were, or did you just have a certain framework that you were going to do for every color that they had on their canvas per artist, per picture?
Well, we started out just looking at all the different, the palette, basically. But then we would start to see features, which I don't even mention in here, about certain, in blacks and stuff, they put dryers in them, and there was a particular, like, copper black. So then I started looking to find trends in that, or to find trends in the trace elements that were happening. There's particular red lakes that I was looking at, like a high potassium red lake. So I started looking for features as I started seeing trends. But we started out by just looking at the palette, and then...
Yeah. We had a minimum that we were sure to, that we covered every color for every artist so that we would then be able to make these comparisons later on, because that was the goal, to have consistent data.
Right.
Thank you, by the way.
Thank you. Oh, actually, we have... Yeah.
Just a quick question. Does the type or quality of the binding material end up affecting the color in any of your analysis?
Do you want to talk about analysis of binding? Well, yeah. Our analysis didn't address binding medium.
No.
We're, from the work that has been done on these artists, they basically are using oil. Yeah, they're using oil paint. And they used good quality oil, like everything else. They were aiming for quality when they could. Sorry, you had it.
It seems to me that sitting at a table to write a letter or even to play a lute could be somewhat awkward. It's covered with a carpet as opposed to a tablecloth. Would that have just been an aesthetic?
It was a style, but if you look at the Mauritshuis painting in the exhibition of a lady writing a letter, and I think the Dublin man writing his letter, and several times you'll see they would just push it to one side. And so the carpet on the table is this wonderful crumpled mass in quite a number of paintings. So yes, it would be very uncomfortable for me at least. Yes.
You mentioned that Vermeer was able to get up to 300 guilders for a painting. Mm-hmm. What would that be today, money?
I'm not totally up on translation, but I can tell you that a typical skilled craftsman was about 600 guilders a year annual income. And this is actually sort of a useful number because that's where a surcharge, a special tax, was imposed. And there are lists of who had to pay that tax. And skilled crafts people, including some artists, straddle that line. So some of them did have to pay the tax, some did not. So it's a pretty good figure for annual income, I think. Yeah.
Why do you think they put carpeting on tables instead of the floor?
It was a style at the time, and I don't know of sources that particularly say why. I think because they were such precious imported materials.
So expensive.
They were very, very expensive. Yeah, we made one wonderful we thought it was wonderful historical observation. Terborch paints carpets, but in his early works, he paints plain table coverings. And late in, as we were just finishing our essay, the fiancé of a colleague in the science department, we suddenly realized, was finishing her dissertation on carpets in paintings. So needless to say, we had some in-depth discussions with Raquel Santos. I've lost her surname, so thank you. Footnote 43 in our essay. Anyway, Raquel confirmed the observation that we suspected, that after those plain table coverings in his early work, Terborch paints twice a single carpet, and then suddenly he paints the same carpet six or seven times, the one that's pushed back in the Mauritshuis painting, the one that's faded in our painting, quite a number. And that's exactly the year he married very well. So we suspect it was a wedding present. Thank you very much for your time.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.